The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Yeah, we're not live. Okay.
Okay.
So, Margaret, welcome back. Margaret Kimberly is a writer for the Black Agenda Report, the author of Prejudicial, Black America and the Presidents. And you're a longtime contributor to the Zero Books podcast and to my earlier podcast, Diet Soap. So it's been too long. There it is. Prejudicial.
I put it up. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi. Good to see you again, Doug.
Well, it's good to see you. I'm glad to have you back. You know, I don't have much of an agenda for this conversation. There's so much going on, and yet it seems at the same time that there's so little going on. I guess what I'll start with is just, I feel as though the Trump administration, the last 4 years, really did a number on the left. Not like we were in such great shape before, but today it is harder than ever to distinguish between left-wing organizations and the Democratic Party.
Yes.
Would you say that's the case? Why do you think that happened?
I think Trump's election was such a trauma. It was a surprise. I didn't see it coming. I did not believe Hillary Clinton was going to win in a landslide. I thought it was going to be closer, but I had no idea she and her campaign and the Democratic Party would fail so miserably. I mean, you raise $1 billion, you can't get 78,000 more votes in the right states. I mean, come on. So it was a shock. He was as bad as advertised. There was a lot of recrimination against anybody who didn't support Hillary Clinton wholeheartedly. Instead of taking responsibility for their failure, everybody was a spoiler. Even if you not supportive of Hillary Clinton, if you had any critique of her at all, if you supported Bernie Sanders instead, it was your fault that Trump won. And what that did is it silenced all except those people who were, well, there's another problem with the word left. We can't seem to agree who's in that group. Politics skews so far to the right in this country. Anybody who's a Democrat gets to call themselves on the left when they are not by my definition of socialist programs to help people here, ending imperialism abroad. That's roughly, if I had to just in a sentence define what leftists are, being opposing neoliberalism, opposing imperialism.
Yeah.
And
we have
a lot of people who call themselves left who aren't really, who were always tied to the Democratic Party. The fact that Trump won gave people the sense that they had only one hope, and that was to support Democrats. And so that meant the left, which was weak to begin with, became weaker. And that's the situation that I think we're in now.
Well, you said something a moment ago that I kind of want to pick at a little bit, which is that after Trump was elected, if you didn't support Hillary Clinton, you were verboten. You were creating a thought, you know, you were breaking the law and doing a thought crime. But I think there was another aspect of the way that the left was absorbed into the Democratic Party. And it was something that at the Black Agenda Report you talked about and wrote about, and not just you, but a number of people wrote about. I think Bruce Dixon said this, that Bernie Sanders was a sheepdog for the Democratic Party. And in 2016, especially during the primaries, it seemed that was his role. But after Trump was elected and there was such a sense of regret over not having given him the nomination, and not putting him up against Trump. There was on the left, or at least on the, let's call it the social democratic left, there was a sense of regret, and there was a doubling down of commitment to Sanders and to changing the Democratic Party, to fighting within the Democratic Party,
right,
to trying to split the Democratic Party. And that's why the DSA absorbed so many Marxist groups after 2016. But it turned out, I mean, from where I'm sitting now, it turned out that that ended up just lining the pockets of the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, that's another part of the story. You're correct. I think I don't think Bernie Sanders intended to be a sheepdog. I think he started off wanting to push Hillary Clinton to the left. I think he did better than he thought he was going to do. But I think as the campaign went on in 2016, he realized he was a viable candidate and he could get the nomination. Now, of course, they weren't going to allow that to happen. And they certainly weren't going to allow it to happen again in 2020. So, yes, that's true. That also happened, what you just described. But I think there's something else going on, and that is that so many people continue to be in denial, to want to believe that the Democratic Party can be the party they want it to be, and not this, you know, monument to neoliberalism, which uses the Republicans as a foil to get away with doing as little as they possibly can. So I think that was true. There was some doubling down. People said, oh, well, Bernie could get the nomination. And I'm glad that people thought that. But the establishment decided that wasn't going to happen. He won Nevada. What a coincidence. Everybody dropped out. They picked Biden as their guy. And, you know, and we're told once again, that's the only choice we have. So what do we see now? Let's see. He said, and he was unequivocal. If we win these seats in Georgia, the two Senate seats, then $2,000 will go right out the door. And they just made a deal for $1,400. And the minimum wage wasn't in the, referring to the COVID stimulus bill. And they're trying, you know, a parliamentarian, I had never heard of this in my life. A Senate parliamentarian said the minimum wage could not be included in the stimulus bill. And that's where we are now. And people, with a variety of reactions, everything from, you know, grumbling about it, but accepting it and believing there's no choice, to people being angry, to people saying this is the best we can get. I had an almost argument with a friend. She's like, well, the Democrats, they want to raise the minimum wage. They want a $2,000. Well, first she said, well, they can't do the $2,000 stimulus. I said, but that's what he said. Does he not know how Congress works? I mean, come on. So we have that reaction, giving them the benefit of the doubt, making excuses for them. But I'm, you know, I support any efforts to build a left. And that has to mean leaving the Democratic Party. I mean, that's where I always come back to. And I'm not a Democrat anyway anymore. But yes, so all of these things from Trump's election, Bernie's failure, the charge that Bernie was ultimately going to sheepherd people back into the Democratic Party fold, which didn't happen completely. I think that's one of the reasons Trump was able to squeak through in the Electoral College. There was a lack of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is old territory now, but I can't help but go over it again because even though I didn't think that Bernie Sanders was going to be able to create a political revolution that would truly transform America, even though I knew that if he got the nomination, there was a good chance that he would lose to Trump. And I think Biden could have lost to Trump as well. I mean, I think it was a lot closer than anyone thought it was going to be this time around. And so there was no guarantees with Bernie. And I also thought that the Democrats would undermine him if he did managed to become president, and that it would likely that he would not get the nomination because they would undermine him at the convention. So, but that's actually, that was what kind of what I wanted to see, was that he would get all the way to the convention. There would be a plurality, and then they would have to really do a dirty deed in public.
Yeah.
But what they actually did, it seems to me, it was sort of too coordinated. I'm not sure if any rules were broken, but it doesn't seem to me to be corrupt. If you have a bunch of people who are politically aligned, mm-hmm. and they're competing for a position, and they, you know, to see who can be get the nomination. But then it comes to a point where their political enemy in the party is making hay out of the fact that they're not unified. And so then they unify. That doesn't seem to me to be corrupt. And it seems to me like it should have been something that the Sanders people were prepared for. Or, you know, that they should have run their campaign in order to beat the strongest opponent rather than to beat a bunch of weak opponents. And I just wonder, what is you think that made Bernie's campaign not strong enough to get the nomination? Why do you think he lost after Nevada? And
well, I think all those weak candidates were in. I think they were all encouraged to be in it. I think that was part of the plan. Let's get as many people as we can, see who is strongest other than Bernie, and then focus on that person. So I think that was part of the plan all along, was to have, mm-hmm. you know, Pete, who heard of the mayor of Nowheresville, Indiana, suddenly he's a viable presidential candidate. I mean, come on. Mm-hmm. So I think that was part of their, the process by the establishment to make sure it was not Bernie. And they were going to let it play out. And then, you know, suddenly they give the order and, you know, everybody's gone and they all, you know, Biden's the guy, everybody steps aside, endorses him, and there you go. But I think Bernie's and his people were more guilty of naivete than anything else. I mean, there was a concerted anti-Bernie effort, constant propaganda against him. Mm-hmm. For example, with black people, I remember it, and it started a couple of years before 2020. I don't know if you remember, he gave a speech in Jackson, Mississippi, and they claimed he disrespected Obama because he only referred to him as a candidate and not the president, which was not true. I actually looked up the speech on YouTube, and he referred to him as the president also. He was talking about the campaign, so it was entirely appropriate for him to refer to him as a candidate and not as president in that instance. Then there was, he always gave his own speech after the State of the Union. And Stacey Abrams was chosen to give the Democratic response. And he went on Facebook after she was on all the networks, and people said it was disrespectful and how dare. I mean, this was very, very coordinated propaganda. It's the kind of thing that went on a fairly regular basis for 4 years. I think, how could that succeed? I think you're right. Even if he got the nomination, it would have been McGovern all over again. The Democrats would have abandoned him. You would have to have a really well-organized movement outside of the confines of electoral politics in order for him, A, to get the nomination, and B, win. Now, as far as Trump winning, I thought Trump was going to win again. I really did.
He did, of course. He did. Those votes that they stored them under a table. Didn't you see? No, okay. Go ahead.
I thought he could do what he did before and win the Electoral College again. I didn't anticipate COVID happening. Mm. And I think even him getting COVID hurt him. But he got 10 million more votes than he got the first time.
Yeah.
I think the Democrats, they did what they should have done. In 2016, they just assumed Hillary was going to win. That's how he squeaked through. So he had a lot of help, a lot of buy-in. You know, people are now calling it a cabal, which is crazy. I think that's a silly word to use in this instance. They were committed to getting Biden through, which was no small feat. He wasn't popular. He was just Obama's sidekick. He is kind of dumb. He did appear to have dementia. He seemed to be unwell to me. I don't know how to describe it. I don't know if they got the right cocktail together or what they did to pull him together. But and they had Trump. He was running against Trump. So I think ultimately whoever got the nomination was going to be Trump, because there were millions of people who wanted Trump gone. So I think Bernie could have won again if he had had a Democratic Party on the up and up and not trying to deep six him all the time. So I'm not one who wants to criticize him or his people that much. Mm-hmm. I think he's guilty of naivete. He thought they would, do the right thing and just let him win. That wasn't going to happen.
So what do you think it is? You mentioned these propaganda attacks on Bernie. Mm-hmm. Do you think that those kinds of attacks really play to the broad base, black voters in the Democratic Party? Or do you think that those are targeted at elites within the party?
Oh, is it more? First of all, there are two things about black voters. First of all, I think it resonated with black people in general. The first thing is, all you have to do, black people, and unfortunately our politics have devolved into just wanting to keep Republicans out of office. So our goal is to make sure Republicans don't get in. That means we will accept just about anything. And that's one of the points of my book. So people like Bill Clinton, who did many racist things during his campaign in 1992, from executing a mentally ill black man to having a photo op with prisoners in Georgia, the sister soldier moment, but everybody coalesced around him because he wasn't a Republican. So that's the first thing. What that means also is, if you cast in, and the other thing they did, the other anti-Bernie propaganda was, well, you may want Medicare for all, but white people, you can't trust white people to vote for things you want. So even if it's something you want yourself, he can't win. So it doesn't matter that he's talking about things you want. And that's one of the most successful ways to get black voters to turn against anybody is to cast doubt on their ability to win. And so that's all you have to do. Just, well, if he can't win, if I'm not sure he can win, if I'm not sure the establishment's behind him, that he can raise money, white people won't vote for him, I'm not going to take a chance and vote for somebody, even if they're talking about the things that I want. And then, of course, it was Bernie. It was always very weird to me. Bernie doesn't get black people. I don't know what that meant. If you could vote for Bill Clinton, you could vote for anybody. What the hell does that mean?
Bill Clinton was the first black president. Don't you remember? Yeah. He went on Arsenio. He played the saxophone.
Wore sunglasses and played the sax. So, and then there was this meme. I don't know if you saw this. It was a meme of, because Bernie was saying the establishment was against him, which was true. I mean, objectively, I think, provable. And there was this meme of some older black ladies in big hats. It looked like they were in a church. And the text, the graphic was something like, they're saying this is the Democratic Party establishment, as if Bernie was saying black people didn't want him. I mean, and that obviously was a lie. So those are the things they did that I think he still was unprepared for. If he was going to run again, he had to go all out and really have a movement behind him, which I'm not trying to say that would be an easy thing to do. But I have actually concluded now that progressives shouldn't bother running in the Democratic Party for president. I think it's a losing proposition.
I want to go back to something you said before about the pessimism that has gripped black Americans and black Democratic voters. And I just tell you a little anecdote. I when you're on Facebook, you have all these different friends. I have thousands of socialists who I'm friends with on Facebook. And you don't always you can watch what they're doing without them even knowing it. So I was lurking, you know, and on my newsfeed, and I saw a conversation between a young black socialist and his family about Bernie Sanders and versus Biden and who they should vote for in the primaries and why they needed to really support Bernie. And the line that really stuck with me was something like what you said, which was, listen, black people should not expect anything from white politics. And but so we're not going to get excited about this senator from Vermont. We don't expect to get anything out of white politics, which is why we're going to vote for Biden. Which is why we're going to support the candidate who promises what we believe we can get, which is less damage, which is like nothing rather than something bad. And I messaged him and I said, how do you deal with that? What do you think people should say to that kind of response? And, you know, does your family feel this alienated from all of their life, or is it just politics? Something I was wondering, because I don't think most people would go through most of their life thinking I can't get anything out of this relationship over here, or you know, my job. And people try to win most of the time. They're not that defeated, but when it comes to politics, they are. How do we get around that kind of pessimism? I mean, it's well earned, right? But
yes, I mean, there's some justification. It's like all black politics now amounts to harm reduction. That's it. That's all. And even if you point out to people that Biden said 2,000 and it's 1,400, and he said the $15 minimum wage plan was for it to be $15 4 years from now, it's already not adequate. And you're still getting no, and they, you know, make up some story about a parliamentarian. It does not matter, because Donald, especially after Trump, Trump was the nightmare, the openly racist white man who managed to become president and galvanize other racist people and make them feel free to come out of the closet. That is the nightmare, the worst thing.
But he gained with black voters in this last election.
Did he?
Didn't he? Yeah.
Some small amount. It was once you're president, you're going to get, you know, everybody loves a winner, right? So
I guess. But I mean, he got more of the black vote both times than Mitt Romney did. And he gained with Latino and black voters.
About Mitt Romney, he did better in 2020 than 2016, but he did worse. Generally, the Republican will get 10% of the black vote. I think in 2016, he got like 5%. And I think this time he was back up to 10. So it was like the traditional.
I'll fact check that. But my understanding is that in both times, he did better than a traditional moderate Republican and across the board with minority voters, and specifically with black voters. Not that he did well, but just like, right, you know, like it's in 2020, it was specifically black men who voted for him in greater numbers. Like he almost doubled the number, but it was still a small number.
It's still a small number, but I'm sorry, what was the original question?
My point was just that I told myself that the fear of Trump was more a kind of upper middle class liberal thing than it was across the board working class thing, or something that had really gripped black Americans across the board. But maybe I'm wrong.
It was across the board. And you're right about black people being so defeated. And most people will own it. They'll say, well, this is all we can get. And yes, I would like more. I would like X, Y, or Z. But this is not the way the system works. The best we can get is to keep people like that out of office. And people will defend their pessimism, defend their defeatism. And it is very sad to see there is that much cynicism. And yes, there are reasons for it. It's, you know, not something that people have imagined a reason for, but there's a bigger problem in that in the last, it's been a couple generations now since there was any kind of mass movement that was able to move the needle politically. It's been a long time. And you know, everybody wants to talk about the civil rights movement, this grand heyday, but not talk about what it accomplished and how it was accomplished, that people were mobilized to make demands of the system, knowing the system did not want to meet their demands, and they made them anyway. And if you're going to talk about that time, that's what you should say. But that degree of mobilization and organization, sadly, is long past. One of the ways the system co-opted Black people was to elevate a certain number of us to high position, culminating, of course, in Obama becoming president. Enough people doing well enough for a certain amount of time for people to think their situation was less urgent. And the end result is this complete collapse, this capitulation. And I predict it won't matter. Biden will, most Black, I don't know what Biden would have to do. I mean, look at his history, being in the right wing of the Democratic Party, being the point man against busing for school integration, bragging about the crime bill, which put thousands of Black people in prison. But he gets the nod of the Democratic Party and all is forgotten. The stupid stories about corn popping and so forth, that's all forgotten. And he's remembered as being Obama's sidekick, and that's enough. So yes, it is unfortunately true that there is that degree of defeatism that and of course it's all topped off with the January 6th Capitol riot. So anybody who said Trump, I don't like Trump, but he's not a fascist, or I don't like Trump, but he's not a Russian agent, or anybody who qualified opposition to Trump in any way is now completely dismissed, because Trump proved the worst thoughts that people had about him. So so that's unfortunately where we are now.
Do you think that Trump intentionally created a situation where people would storm the Capitol, and that he was trying to perpetuate an insurrection and stop the vote from being certified?
It's not clear to me what his, I would love to know what his expectation was that day. Did he, I think he probably did. He probably thought he could, because just the weekend before the, you know, his conversation with the Georgia Secretary of State, where he said, I need 11,000 some odd votes. He had an exact number of votes he needed. He wanted them to overturn the election. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats actually should have started impeachment proceedings January 4th, that Monday, because they had proof, absolute proof. He was trying to disenfranchise people and undo the election. So I don't know what he thought those, you know, people would do once they got into the Capitol. But he's also a person who I don't think thinks very far ahead. So I don't know what he thought was going to happen, but he wanted to stay in. And it's funny to me because he was the accidental president. He started off not thinking he was going to get the Republican nomination back in 2016, and he got it, and then thinking he wasn't going to win, and he won. But he, you know, once he had the job, he was determined, as any of his predecessors, to keep it. Mm-hmm. So I think, yes, he did think he could somehow create a crisis or somehow keep Biden from being declared the winner.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. The thing about Trump is you can never underestimate his stupidity, I think.
True, too. His contradictions of him and why it's hard to sometimes analyze him in his behavior.
Yeah. Right. Going back, I want to go back to this question of pessimism in Black America. And I think it's not just Black America. I think Overall, working class people are pessimistic. regular people are pessimistic about politics. It's pretty common just to hear, you know, they're all crooks. I don't get involved. I don't follow it. And it turns into kind of apathy. But it also can turn into a vote for conservatives and within the Democratic Party, or if you're in white working class, it can turn into voters for Republicans, strangely. But I wondered, do you think it would be possible for the Democratic Party or for some bipartisan effort to create a situation in America where, let's say, along the lines of income, education attainment, and let's just leave it there, those two. And let's get really optimistic in life expectancy. There would be rough equality between the races. Not that there would be rough equality between the classes, but that there would be the same level of poverty amongst all the races. There'd be the same level of premature death. Do you think that is a possibility in the future for America?
Well, it is it possible? I mean, yes, it is possible.
Do you think that would be good for the parties if that happened?
Sure, it would. I mean, you would have. First of all, people, if the parties, the Democrats have been living on this now undeserved reputation as being the party that helps working people, if they actually did help working people, they would get more whites. Most white people still vote for Republicans.
Yeah, but you're not hearing me. Working people would be just as poor as ever. There would be equality between the races, not between the classes. So that means that the same number of people, it could be more white people than before. It could be the same number of people would be poor as now. It would just be equally distributed amongst the races.
And if that happened, your question then is what? Just to make sure.
Would that be good for the parties, or would that create a problem for the parties?
Oh, well, so you're talking about there being more poor white people.
That's not necessarily, but possibly. Just that certainly it wouldn't. The problems of the working class and working class poverty, they go up and down anyway, right? The level of poverty goes up and down overall. So the problems would be shared. They would not be unequal between the races. It would be the same.
That probably
would mean right now that more white people would become poor. But it could mean that in a boom time, that more black people became wealthy, but they would still be inequality between the classes. This is a hypothetical, but there is a kind of politics which focuses pretty much exclusively on racial inequality to the exclusion of class. So that would mean, you would have 13% of the population in seats of power. You would have 13% of the population. 13% of the CEOs in America would be black, because 13% of America is black.
Okay.
So you see what I'm saying? But then everything else would sort of work out that same way as well. So the most poor people would still be 13%,
instead of whatever the real percentage is.
I think twice that or three times.
No, it's like just one statistic off the top of my head. Half of all homeless people are black, and we're not half of people in prison are black. So
yeah, right. Those would be huge things to overcome.
Yeah,
to change those things. But I think they would be. I think that would be not so impossible. It wouldn't be structurally impossible. Like you can't get rid of class and keep capitalism. You might be able to get rid of this inequality between the races.
Well, but America is so racist. No, to answer your question, to give the short answer, that would not help. The white vote would, white people would vote against whoever did that. I think I'm answering your question now.
Okay. Yeah.
That would not bode well for electorally for whomever did that. If race, I think this is what you're saying, if race was not the determining factor in where people ended up.
Well, it's interesting because in 2008 through 2016, the difference in wealth, I think, and life expectancy, between black people and white people began to narrow. The white Americans started doing worse, and their decline in life expectancy happened, whereas the life expectancy of black people still worse than white people, but it stayed kind of steady. So there was a decline.
Well, that was the 2008, the crash, the Great Recession,
right?
Mm-hmm. Which people still have not recovered from. And it's very interesting. You see among white people, so many behaviors are ascribed to that, like opioid use, and there's been a decline, as you point out, declining life expectancy. People lost jobs, they lost living wage jobs, they're now in gig work. I feel like everybody I know who owns a car is driving for Uber or Lyft. And that's an indicator of what you're talking about. Black people lost, you know, the little bit of wealth black people had was tied up in home ownership. So that was devastating for us. I mean, we took a huge step backwards in income, in wealth accumulation, in...
especially in wealth, most of all, right?
Yes, student loan debt, which is a talk about something else Biden could do, but hasn't done anything about. All of these things have been really devastating to black people. Now, how to fix that? It's actually not hard. You can fix it by the government stepping in. You know, the reason, I know I'm getting off track a little bit, but...
it's fine. I mean, that was just a kind of a brain fart question, so go ahead.
That was an interesting fart, so to speak. about this issue of the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. Why do Democrats not want the minimum wage to go up? The short answer is their donors don't. They do not, the last thing they want to see, they want workers to be as insecure as possible. That gives them more and more power. There's that. And that means there's an expectation among everybody that their wages have gone up. Real wages in this country haven't gone up in like 40 years or something like that. The idea of the government intervening to help people is the last thing they want to see. So this is a situation we are in. We have two parties who are, there are Democrats pushing back, not enough. And by the way, there are Democrats who are also very conservative. They don't want the minimum wage to go up. As an aside, here in New York City, it's already $15 an hour, and the sky didn't fall, and businesses didn't go under, and at any rate. But that is where we are. But the thing that keeps many white people keeps them tied to this, to be system affirming, is to think that they're going to be okay. So if you had a situation where they were not okay, where their situation was, I think that's what you're saying, would be equivalent to that of black people. They would be as likely to be poor, not to be able to own a house, all of those things.
The weird thing is, because the percentage of people in America that are black is 13%, to adjust the number so everyone's equal wouldn't necessarily mean a huge decline in wealth amongst white people. Because there are so many more white people,
right?
We're talking about what might end up being a fairly minor correction in terms of raw number of dollars to redistribute.
Yeah, I don't think it would be a small number. I think it's so funny how everything is relative. White people don't do as well. Even in flush times, don't do as well as they seem to think.
Right.
They know they're doing better than black people, and they like it that way. They want to know that they are a step above. Their income is higher. Their opportunities are greater. The possibilities are greater for them.
I think after a certain level right now, like amongst classes, like the lower down you go, like working class and below, like, you know, the lower middle class to poor, the difference in wealth between the races is really small. The differences become much bigger the higher the income. So when you stop, when you don't include millionaires and billionaires in the stats, the numbers, the wealth gap and the
I'm not sure.
Income
I
gap.
The numbers with me. I remember a few years ago, there was some horrible statistic. It was about Boston particularly. I don't know if you saw this, that the net worth of Black people in Boston was like $10. I mean, it was some horrible.
Yeah.
So
that would be like in cash in reserve, like they're living month to month. Like if you lived paycheck to paycheck, you would have no net worth, right?
Basically, I mean, that's
right.
That was like an average. So there were people who still, you know, owned a house or still had a pension or still had something.
Right. And there were millions of people or hundreds of thousands of people who were massively in debt.
Yes.
Who had negative wealth.
Exactly. So then it came up to like $10 or something like that. And people said, can you check the numbers again? And, you know, apparently it did stand up. So I think if you had this equality of result, white people would be very, very angry because that would be a huge decline for them. I'm pretty certain that would not bode well for the political system if white people's opportunities were diminished that much.
Well, that's a separate kind of thing. Like you have a moment where wealth equality is established. That doesn't mean it's going to stay. You know, because the system is constantly moving. So like you're not going to hold on to it. You'd have to have more equality, I think, especially amongst the upper classes and high income.
Right. When you talk about that, there's so few Black people who can really be called upper income. It's a small number of people. You know, even people where everything looks okay. Let's say they own a house. Let's say they're sending a kid to college. You know, then you find out when you get the details, they've borrowed against their house. The kids are taking out student loans. Even these people who are allegedly middle class, their situation is very often precarious. Now they're doing better than one of these people with negative wealth. Yes. And the lack of generational wealth really hurts us. You know, I know it's not all white people, but many white people are not, they're not starting from scratch. If their parents can't swing the college tuition, the grandma and grandpa can help. If they're buying their first home, they can get help to help meet the down payment. These are things we generally don't have. And it really sets us back in so many ways. And if we lose a job, it's the end. I mean, people that's I just said half of all homeless people are Black. That's why. If anything goes wrong, you're just done for. Without any safety, no social governmental safety net, no family safety net. And I think white people would not accept being in that position.
Yeah. Well, more than half of white people already are in that position.
Yeah.
More than half of white people are in the position where if they lose their job, they're fucked. I mean, I know, like, I didn't come from that background, so I'm not, like, talking, I mean, you know, out of moral authority here. I just know people who, like, white people who would give me shit about my background because they would say, yeah, Doug, you fucked around a lot in your 20s and I went to work and I climbed the ladder and I did as much as I could to get as much as I could. And I didn't go to parties and I didn't write poetry. And I became a manager at the cinema and then I actually went back to school and became, got a corporate job and they sent me back to school. And, you know, I got more advanced degrees while I was working through the corporate structure. Why? Because if I couldn't pay my rent, that was it. You know, if I couldn't save up some money, I had no security.
Right.
You know, my parents were dirt poor. Which means basically they had jobs and they had a place to live, but they had no savings. There was no wealth behind them. And that's most, of, lower middle class to certainly working class white people in America.
Right. Well, you know, this whole thing is something that's just never discussed here. I mean, half of all American workers are low income. This is something that is rarely acknowledged. The degree to which people are struggling, and but it's so we do have a class system here, but it's not acknowledged. It's rarely talked about, but we do have that. We do have millions of people who are struggling. I mean, the fact that anybody other than a teenager is earning this paltry minimum wage is disgraceful. I mean, but it's true. There are people, you know, adults working these jobs. But it's, you know, everything is, you know, you can't claim to be the greatest country in the world and be exceptional and also acknowledge what we have just been talking about. Something has to give. You can't tell that lie. So you just
I'll tell you another little story. My roommate is 68 years old. His name is Jim Ferris. He was my boss when I, one of the first people to hire me when I came to Portland at the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, which was one of my first jobs. I got that job because they would hire you if you were breathing. And I went out, you know, door to door to collect checks for the environment. And then we worked together at the American Heart Association. We worked at the Shakespeare Theater Company. We worked at the Oregon Symphony together. And he lived in a little apartment in a house in Northeast Portland the whole time, like for 27 years. And then they sold the house and he had no real savings. He was on living at that time on Social Security. So he's living here. That was living with us was his fallback position. Right. And we're glad to have him, although he sometimes irritates the hell out of me, but you know, it's a generational thing. But anyhow, yeah. But I mean, that's another white person in America who has no wealth and who was working his whole life, you know, different jobs. And you know, his father was a milkman.
Yeah. So. Yeah. There are people, I know people like that. They still, when they talk about retirement, I'm that age, people are talking about retirement. I know white people are like, I can't retire. I'm going to work till I drop. It's
right. Well, he can't keep work. He had medical issues. He can't work.
Exactly.
So he has to live on Social Security.
Point where that, you know, often is the issue. But it's, you know, this whole idea that everybody doesn't succeed, just in general, this idea that this is the, you know, the land of opportunity or whatever people want to call it. And that there are people who are not succeeding by any measure, who are struggling by every measure, but aren't talked about, aren't seen on TV commercials, not seen on TV shows, aren't on the news, aren't even when they talk about, you know, the white working class. And I don't know what that means, because there are working class white people who have living wage income.
Oh yeah.
A construction worker, a cop, you know, all kinds of people they're doing okay.
No, there's a stratification within the working class as well, for sure. And what I wonder right now is, like, are we looking at 2008 again? Are we looking at another kind of round of proletarianization of the population, meaning and making of another big group of people no longer relevant to our society?
I think so. This whole gig work thing, I mean, just it seemed to me to happen overnight. It's like, you're not going to have which is the best thing to be an employee, you know, people are working for Amazon and, you know, renting out rooms and driving for Uber and all of these things, this horrible proposition that passed in California, supposedly liberal state, which, you know, permanently exiled these people into being contractors, not employees, and therefore disposable, and therefore living in precarity. And even when the, you know, the fascist gets kicked out, you get more precarity, but with a smile, you know, you don't get dumb tweets with it. But I think that is what we're headed for that to become solidified. And how much will people take? You know, there's something else I wanted to talk about. When we talk about January 6th, and we talked about the weakness of the left, could you get that many leftists to mobilize in Washington for any reason? I mean, not to do that thing.
Look, you did just crazy. Over the summer, they made Trump hide in his bunker outside. There were so many.
A funny thought, but then what happened? It's almost like it didn't happen. It's very strange. That means it can happen again. I think the election had a lot to do with it. I think the election, electoral politics sucks a lot of air out of movement spaces, I think. And everything boiled, especially with Trump. And talk about your state. They you know, he ordered these federal goons to kill that man.
That story, you want to look at, like, remember Kyle Rittenhouse, like the kid who shot three guys? Now, I don't know, like, if you look at that, what Kyle did, it's really unclear. He could get off on self-defense. I don't know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But the point here is when they didn't arrest him right away, they certainly didn't go after him and shoot him dead. Right?
They did not.
This guy who shot a guy who it could also have been self-defense. We don't know what happened in downtown Portland with these people. They pulled up onto his property, got out of the car, and they had shot him dead within like 30 seconds.
Yes.
He was brandishing a gummy worm and a cell phone. I mean, that was his, they said he was armed.
Their goal was to kill.
It was an assassination. It was just a straight up assassination.
Absolutely. And I think, Trump doing, things like that, I think it's a combination of things. The protests last summer after George Floyd was killed, there was a lack of organization. I thought it was very impressive that there were so many people, that there were so many, an interracial movement. I thought it was very impressive, but it petered out because of the election, because they know how to buy people off. So, and we've got to stop being such cheap dates on the left too. So foundations are giving money and corporations are giving money. And Jamie Dimon, the head of Chase Bank, is taking a knee. Everybody was taking a knee. And colleges change their curriculum. Everybody changes their language.
I could use DoorDash and order from black restaurants in town. It was my first option on DoorDash.
What was I just going to say? Or they come up with new word. Now you're BIPOC. I refuse to use that word. Nobody protested in order to get a new word. I'm still black. Thank you very much. You can keep BIPOC. But
what does BIPOC stand for? Is that like you're bisexual and a person of color?
Black indigenous person of color.
Okay.
That just means anybody, you lump together everybody who's not white. Or then it was, what else was it? They took Aunt Jemima off the box and you couldn't watch Gone with the Wind. And I don't care if you watch Gone with the Wind. Go ahead and watch it. I can give a shit. But, you know, Nancy Pelosi taking a knee with Kente cloth. So I think some of, you know, everybody is not as strong, and people can be, you know, co-opted with just the tiniest bit. I think all of those things caused that movement to suffer.
You know, Margaret, what we usually do, what I try to do is when I have someone on, I have them on for a little longer than normal. So I create the first draft or the first podcast for everybody. And then I ask them to join me for a second round. Do you have time for a second round?
Sure. How much more time?
Let's say 30 minutes to 40 minutes, maybe tops.
No, let's say half hour. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So people who stick around and who join up for the Patreon will get to have a half hour more of Margaret Kimberly. For $5, you get to hear the real stuff.
Because
I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I know about BIPOC and the George Floyd protests that happened in Oregon. Because my kids were involved. So I'm going to rat out my kids a little bit.
Okay.
So people who have to go to the Parrot Room can hear that. Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week,
and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.